Okay, so I'm actually going to be talking about equilibrium thermodynamics. Well, equilibrium physics. By definition, thermodynamics is an equilibrium. And I'm going to be talking about certain aspects of the N equals 4 theory, the thermodynamics of the N equals 4 theory on a three-sphere. And I suspect that there are many people in the audience who are quite familiar with large portions of what I'm going to talk about. But I think there are also people in the audience who are probably not familiar with some of these details. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about is also going to be review material, which is familiar to many people. So maybe I should start by saying what I'm not going to talk about. We know that gauge theories in general exhibit a very rich variety of phases, thermodynamic phases, and of course probably the best known example is our QCD theory, which is believed to have this kind of a phase structure, which is incredibly rich. But the theory I'm going to talk about for the most part is nowhere near as rich as this theory. Doesn't mean as it doesn't have a rich thermodynamic phase structure. The only thing that I want to take, that I kind of want to point out in this particular graph, which distinguishes QCD from the theory that we are talking about, is specifically that QCD does not have a confinement-deconfinement phase transition, because it has quarks in the fundamental representation. And this is the key difference between QCD and the theory that we are interested in. The theory that we are interested in is a lot closer to the simpler example of pure Young-Mills theory in 3 plus 1 dimensions. So it's actually essentially pure Young-Mills plus adjoint matter. Okay. So, and we know that pure Young-Mills in 3 plus 1 dimensions, by virtue of the fact that it has only adjoint matter, it has a center symmetry, a Zn valued center symmetry, meaning that the fields don't transform under this transformation. So, and if we want to study this is particularly relevant if we want to study the thermodynamics of this theory. And if we want to study the thermodynamics of this theory, what we do is, in order to study the equilibrium properties, we put the theory on R3 cross S1, right? And what is interesting is what happens to this order parameter, the parameter that actually transforms under these Zn transformations, which is the Polyakov loop, which is just the trace of the exponential. It's the Wilson loop around the time-like, the Euclidean time-like direction, and it's the object that transforms under this Zn symmetry. So the thermodynamics of this system, the states of the system, are completely characterized by the expectation value for this particular order parameter. And in particular, what we know is that this order parameter, the Polyakov loop, it measures the free energy associated to a static quark in the plasma or in the finite temperature ensemble. And in particular, you know that at very low temperatures, if I take a quark-antiquark pair, a test quark-antiquark pair in the plasma, then the quark-antiquark pair at low temperatures will have a linear potential. And so that means that if I actually compute a two-point correlator involving the Polyakov loops, then you will find that the two-point correlator is actually proportional to the exponential of minus the potential between this quark-antiquark pair. And since the potential goes to infinity at long distances, the correlation function between two Polyakov lines actually goes to a constant at large distances, and essentially vanishes at large distances. And so that means that in the low temperature phase, the Polyakov loops vanish. And then you say that the theory is in the confined phase.
How did the Polyakov loop transform under Zn? Just by phase?
Yeah, just by phase, exactly. So, and in the high temperature phase, when the theory is deconfined, you can argue that the Polyakov loop gets a non-zero expectation value, and in particular, because this is an order parameter that transforms under Zn, you say that Zn is broken, the Zn symmetry. And this was originally argued by Svetitsky and Larry. And in particular, the order of the transition is first order, and except in the case when n equals 2, when it's actually in the same universality class as the Ising universality class. So, this class of theories, pure Yang-Mills and QCD, these have interesting thermodynamics, basically in the thermodynamic limit, which means that we are taking the large volume limit. Now, we also know that Yang-Mills-like theories have interesting thermodynamic properties when we take a different kind of thermodynamic limit. In particular, this is a thermodynamic limit which involves not necessarily a large volume limit, but actually a large NC limit, the number of colors going to infinity. And the study of these things has, these kinds of theories, has recently received a lot of interest, primarily for two reasons. Well, the main motivation and the motivation for this talk is in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence, which links, as you know, n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills at large n to string theory on ADS-5 cross S5. There also has been a fair amount of interest in studying QCD or Yang-Mills-like theories with fields and transforming in various representations of the gauge group on finite volume in order to understand or in order to distinguish between... So there's been a conjecture that certain kinds of QCD-like theories, which are actually distinct at finite n, could actually be equivalent to each other at infinite n. And in order to test this, this proposed conjecture, people have studied these Yang-Mills theories on finite volumes and try to understand their phase structure. But our main interest is from the viewpoint of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And so we know that from the point of view of the ADS-CFT correspondence, we know that we should think of the field theory as living on the boundary of the bulk geometry. In this case, the bulk geometry is ADS-5, and in global coordinates, the boundary of ADS-5 is actually a sphere, so it's actually S3 cross time. So we should think of n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills living on S3 cross time. At finite temperature, if we want to study equilibrium properties, then we should think of this time-like direction being compact, and so the n equals 4 theory lives on S3 cross S1, which is the boundary of Euclidean ADS-5 space with a thermal circle. And in principle, there could be... This specifies only the asymptotics of the Euclidean spacetime, so there could be other things in the interior. So there are two parameters. If I want to study the thermodynamics of the n equals 4 theory on S3 cross S1, there are two dimensionless parameters. The first is, of course, the Tuft coupling of the n equals 4 theory, which is a completely tunable, exactly marginal parameter. So I can change it from 0 to infinity. And the other dimensionless parameter is the combination of temperature and the radius, T times R. So I can essentially play with these two dials. And the other thing to note is that n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills has a Zn symmetry because it has adjoint matter. So in this sense, it is similar to the pure Yang-Mills theory. And there are two tractable regimes of the n equals 4 theory at n equals infinity. So one tractable regime is lambda tending to infinity, the Tuft coupling tending to infinity, which is precisely the limit in which the theory is described by classical supergravity, which is tractable. But there is also, of course, another tractable regime, which is the weak coupling regime, where lambda is much less than 1. So actually, in principle, we should really be studying both regimes and trying to understand how one regime differs from the other qualitatively, or how similar the two different regimes are qualitatively. So we know that, and we have heard a lot about about how supergravity on ADS-5 yields us strong coupling field theory dynamics. So for example, transport coefficients of the strongly coupled system. But we want to look at this duality from a slightly different perspective, which is we want to ask whether the gauge theory at weak coupling can actually provide, can actually tell us something about gravity. Okay, so that's the motivation, but of course there's no reason that gauge theory at arbitrary weak coupling should actually tell us anything about gravity, because from the point of view of the ADS-CFT correspondence, weak coupling in the gauge theory or weak tuft coupling in the gauge theory corresponds to very strong curvatures in the gravity theory, which means that stringy effects can be very important, and so there need not be anything recognizable about the lambda much less than one limit of the gravitational side of the correspondence. But nevertheless, there are some hints, and the first hint that there might be something in this, that looking at the weakly coupled theory could tell us something about the gravitational setup. The first hint kind of came from work originally done by Sundberg and then later by all these other authors. And what these guys did was they looked at the extreme example of just setting the tuft coupling to zero, lambda equals zero. And you might think that the theory is trivial here, but it turns out that it still has some interesting thermodynamics. So the first thing to note is that when you put the theory on a sphere, the Yang-Mills theory on the sphere, on S3, the Hamiltonian of the N equals 4 theory, the Hamiltonian on the sphere, is actually the generator of dilatation transformations when the theory is formulated on R4. So this can be understood by thinking of the first realizing that N equals 4 theory is conformal, and then if you want to do radial quantization of the conformal field theory on R4, then it's natural that at each given, if the radial direction is identified with time, then it's natural to think of the theory as being formulated on a spatial three-sphere, and the operator that actually generates these dilatations is of course delta, the dilatation operator, which then gets identified with the Hamiltonian of the system. So on S3, the Hamiltonian is actually what you would call the dilatation operator on S4. And all the physical states of this theory, we know they are gauge invariant operators, and they can be single trace operators formed out of the various adjoint fields of the theory. They could be multi-trace operators. In the free theory, the energy of a given operator or a given state is just given basically by the length of the operator, because that's the dimension of the operator, and that would be the eigenvalue of the dilatation operator. So the energy of a typical single trace operator is given by its length. And the number of states with typical energy L or a typical length L actually scales exponentially with L. And that's easy to see even if you have two fields. So if you have two fields, the number of states that you can make of a given length L is 2 to the L. So that means the density of states has a Hagedorn growth. So that means if you try to study the thermodynamics of the system, we would expect that there would be a critical temperature where the ensemble, something funny happens to the partition function. So what these guys did was actually went ahead and computed the partition function of the free theory. And there are various ways to think about it. One way to think about it is actually in the Wilsonian language, which is that on S3 cross S1, the theory has a zero mode, and this zero mode will be identified basically with the Polyakov loop. So e to the I alpha, the homogeneous part of e to the I alpha on S3 cross S1 is the zero mode of the theory, and it's the lightest field in the theory. So you can imagine writing down an effective theory for this lightest mode by integrating out all harmonics, all the heavy states in the theory. So all the Kaluza-Klein harmonics on S1 cross S3 to get an effective action for the zero mode. And not surprisingly, this effective action is a unitary matrix model with some effective action. And the terms in this effective action can be basically expanded in trace U to the M's, which are the multiply wound Polyakov loops. And the first thing to note is, of course, that the action has to be Zn invariant, and so it's a combination of trace U to the M and trace U dagger to the M. And this, and you see that the action is Gaussian in these Polyakov loops. If you include interactions in the theory, what you will find is that you induce actually trilinear terms and so on and so forth. So in the free theory, there is a non-trivial unitary matrix model for this Polyakov loop. Right. So in principle, yes, you can compute, yeah, all the AMs. In the free theory, yes, in principle, you know, all of them. And what will happen, of course, is that as you change the temperature, is there will be some critical temperature where one of the AMs becomes negative, for instance, or changes sign. Okay, and so that's when there is a transition in the system. And there's, of course, a better way to understand this matrix model when you go to the eigenvalue basis for the unitary matrix. And in the eigenvalue basis, you get this picture where you have n particles experiencing a repulsive force, which comes from the van der Moen determinant. And then you have all these potential terms, which can provide you with attractive forces. So what happens is that at low temperatures, you find that the repulsive forces are bigger than the attractive forces. And so these eigenvalues of the Polyakov loop want to spread around the circle. And in the large n limit, they distribute themselves uniformly around the circle. In the large, always thinking about the large n limit. So at low temperatures, the eigenvalues distribute themselves uniformly around the circle. And as you crank up the temperature, what you find is that there is a phase transition where this uniform distribution of eigenvalues around the circle gets a gap. Okay? And
is this a fixed volume?
Volume is fixed.
If you take the volume, it's infinity limit.
So there is only one. So there's only one combination, T times R, which is a dimensionless parameter. So everything is measured in the units of the radius of the three sphere. Right. So you can think of that as fixed and then increasing or decreasing the temperature. So the theory undergoes a transition at a specific temperature, as you can see. It's a pure number in the combination T times R. Okay, and this transition is identified as a deconfinement kind of transition, because if you look at the, as I was saying earlier, if you look at the distribution of the eigenvalues in the large n limit, the eigenvalues are distributed on a circle. At low temperatures, they are in the uniform phase. At high temperatures, there is a gapping, and it's this gapping which leads to phase transition. So if you computed the Polyakov loop expectation value in the uniform phase, the answer is zero. In this gapped phase, the answer is non-zero. So you get Zn breaking. The Zn symmetry is broken. And this is strictly an n equals infinity effect.
Is the temperature the same? Can you obtain that from counting the Gibbs Bernoulli operators?
Yeah. Indeed. So the whole thing, yes, indeed, exactly. They're all equivalent ways of doing the same thing, yes.
But this confinement, the confinement phase transition has nothing to do to the just confinement, the confinement with our real.
It's kinematics. This is kinematic.
Yes, yeah. No interactions, nothing. Essentially.
There's no interactions in this system, yeah. Right, so in any case, n equals 4 theory really, literally, is not, never in a confining phase. So. What we really, it's confining because we put it on finite volume. So it's kinematic confinement. And the idea is that if you can't introduce, you know, a static quark on finite volume without violating Gauss's law, then that's the sense of confinement here. So this phase transition is first order because you can see that across a phase transition, the free energy changes by order n squared. And also you can see that the specific heat is discontinuous. So it's zero at low temperatures, basically, and at high temperature, well, just across the phase transition, it's non-zero. So, and then you can also plot a nice effective potential for the Polyakov loop variable, and you find that at low temperatures, there's a single minimum, and the phase transition is just characterized by this curve flipping. Okay, so it goes from positive curvature to negative curvature. So it's not really like a usual first-order phase transition where you get two local minima in the free energy and then you have an exchange. Okay, so it's almost actually borderline second order, this phase transition. So it's weakly first order. So in fact, at the phase transition point, this potential just becomes exactly flat. Yeah, it's log 1 minus something root 3 or something like that. So you can...
Is there a latent heat in this phase transition?
Uh-huh. Okay, so the specific heat changes. So does that...
At lambda equals 0?
At lambda is...
Non-zero but arbitrarily small.
Well, at lambda equals 0, this is the picture. At lambda arbitrarily small, we don't know what the picture is precisely. We don't know whether it's even first order, whether it's exactly first order, or whether it has, which I'm going to get to. Yeah.
Is the entropy, does the entropy jump the phase transition?
The number of degrees of freedom, so the free energy scaling changes. The free energy jumps by order n squared.
The free energy is always continuous.
It is continuous. It's the first derivative which is discontinuous. Yes. Yeah. No. Oh, good. That's a good point. So there, actually, this has a boundary. This is bounded because it's a unitary matrix and you have a trace. Yeah. So this is the phase where it's in the uniform distribution, and this is the phase where it's kind of clumped. Okay. And yeah, that's a good point actually. It's important that it's bounded, otherwise it wouldn't. So in this sense, it's a Zn breaking or deconfinement transition. And the reason there was interest in this is that this lambda equals zero picture is consistent with the lambda equals infinity picture. Question is how much you want to take away from it, but it's interesting. So at lambda equals infinity, what we know is from the dual gravity is that there is a first order Hawking page transition between two geometries with the same asymptotics, one being thermal ADS space, which has a non-contractible thermal circle and basically describes a gas of gravitons, thermal gas of gravitons in ADS space. And at high temperatures, that geometry undergoes a phase transition to the big ADS black hole where the thermal circle actually contracts at the horizon. Yeah. Yeah, so this is different. Good. So indeed. So at weak coupling, this transition, what we call the deconfinement transition, is coincident with the Hagedorn transition. Exactly. But at strong coupling, the Hagedorn transition is not really a transition. It's a temperature at which two saddle points, a thermal ADS saddle point and you can draw a cartoon at strong coupling of free energy or the action versus some order parameter and you have something like this and this at very high temperatures where, let me try to draw it like this. So this is the black hole phase. At high temperatures, this is preferred. But if you were sitting in this phase and you were kind of in a superheated phase, then at a still higher temperature, this saddle point and this saddle point will merge. And that's the Hagedorn temperature. And that's different from the Hawking page temperature at strong coupling.
What is this parameter?
This is the Polyakov loop, and actually, recently there has been this cartoon has actually been derived from gravity by Matt Heydrich. So he has found an effective potential for the the Maldacena-Polyakov loop from gravity. Yeah, so what he did was, I think he introduced kind of a Lagrange multiplier for this Polyakov loop. So that was basically so the Polyakov loop is measured by the string world sheet, so he introduced actually a stress tensor sourcing such a membrane wrapping the black hole cigar. And then with that Lagrange multiplier in place, I think he solved the equations of motion. I don't know. Should probably look at his paper more carefully. Is that what he did? That's what he did. Yeah. He has this plot. Yeah.
So why is the merging of these two extrema? Why do I identify this one with the Hagedorn?
Well, you can think of it in this way that the Hagedorn temperature is associated with the condensation of winding modes, right? So if you are sitting in the black hole phase, the winding modes are already condensed, right? Because the cigar has shrunk to, it shrinks to zero size at the horizon. So if you're sitting, so you can only see the thermal ADS. So if you're sitting in the thermal ADS phase, then the condensation of winding modes at high temperature is literally a second order phase transition, which is precisely from the point of view of this superheated phase, right? And that's exactly what happens. You crank up the temperature, and as soon as these two guys merge, right, you roll down, basically. That's a cartoonish picture. So in gravity, so you can also compute the Polyakov loop in gravity, except that you don't quite have the Polyakov loop in ADS space. You have something which is slightly more complicated, which is the A0 plus scalars of the N equals 4 theory, but it's still an operator that transforms under Zn. And in this case, because there's a contractible circle, this operator, its expectation value turns out to be non-zero, because the way you evaluate it in gravity is just by wrapping a Euclidean string world sheet around this cigar, and modulo regularizations, you get a finite answer, and that tells you that this object is non-zero. So this is confinement deconfinement.
So on the gravity side, there is a parametric difference between this temperature and the radiation.
Huge. The Hagedorn's phase transition occurs at the string scale.
So this phase transition, that recoupling, is going to somehow split into two.
Right. So I guess one should have had some diagram like this. So if you plot 0 to infinity in coupling space and temperature, then there's some temperature where you get this Hagedorn phase transition, and then there's a Hawking page phase transition, and then you can draw a dotted line that's Hagedorn.
So splitting is happening for arbitrarily small lambda?
Arbitrarily small lambda. Okay, so this picture at arbitrarily small but non-zero lambda is yet unresolved because of the following fact that if you include interactions, then it's kind of easy to see that the first term that you want to keep ahead of the Gaussian terms in the effective potential for the Polyakov loop, the U1, looks like a coefficient B times mod U1 to the fourth power. And depending upon whether B is positive or negative, of course, different things can happen. Okay. So it turns out that this coefficient B is actually order lambda squared. So lambda being the Tuft coupling. So this is actually, in principle, to determine this correctly, you have to do at least a three-loop calculation, two and three-loop calculations on a three-sphere in n equals 4 theory. So that's highly non-trivial, and that's why it hasn't really been done. But this calculation has been done by the same bunch of people, and for pure n equals for pure Yang-Mills theory, and they have found that for that case, B is strictly less than zero for pure Yang-Mills. So the two situations, the two possibilities for n equals 4 theory, which ought to be settled by a clear-cut calculation, is that for B less than zero, the theory has, so this is, theory has a first order phase transition here at strong coupling, has a first order phase transition at small weak coupling, and you can imagine that probably all the way through there's only a single transition line as you go from weak to strong coupling. Of course, this need not be the case, you can have all sorts of stuff happening in between. In the case that B turns out to be greater than zero, it turns out that as soon as you move away from zero coupling, you find that there are actually two phase transitions, the first one being second order, and the second one being a third order phase transition. And you can see why that's the case by just taking this potential, this quartic potential, and plugging in the two possible signs, and you see what happens as you crank up the temperature. It's quite easy. It is not known. So the simplest possibility, of course, is that these two merge at some critical value of the coupling and then become a single first order line. But then all sorts of things can happen between. And in fact, a non-trivial question that one would like to settle is that there is no strong weak phase transition, for example, at least at high temperatures. Or whether, I mean, the question is whether there is one or there isn't. Okay, so that's an important question.
But let's assume B larger than zero. For small lambda, can you say what kind of phases realize between these two lines?
So you can, yeah. So these phases will be characterized by the eigenvalue distributions. So that's the only way I can characterize the phases. So in this phase, at low temperatures, the eigenvalue distribution will be uniform. If once you get here, the eigenvalue distribution will be non-uniform. Okay, and as you cross this line, there's a third order Gross-Witten transition, and across that, you get a gap distribution. So gapped, ungapped, but non-uniform, and uniform. Those are the three phases. Right, and what this corresponds to in a gravity language, well.
I understand the third order.
From here to here,
yeah.
That's a crossover. So that just from plotting this effective potential.
Not a crossover. It's like
sorry.
Conventional second order.
Second order transition. So it's. So if you plot V
as a transition,
the Polyakov line will become massless. Yeah. So basically, the point is if B was greater than zero, right? Then at high temperatures, you would get an effective potential that looks like this. Then at low temperatures, you get an effective potential that looks like this. At high temperatures, it's kind of bends down and does that. Okay, so in between, there's a critical temperature. And the third order line is when the third order transition is reached, when this minimum actually hits the boundary of configuration space. That's when the gapping occurs. Okay, so we don't know which one of these two is realized because nobody has done this hard calculation, right? But that doesn't mean that we can't ask interesting questions about the interacting theory. Questions that don't depend upon two and three loop effects, but questions that just depend on one loop effects. Right, so an interesting thing to do in n equals 4 theory, of course, to extend the phase diagram, is to now introduce new thermodynamic potentials. So the n equals 4 theory has a global symmetry. It has an SU4 global symmetry or SO6 global symmetry under which the scalars of n equals 4 theory and the fermions are also charged. Okay, so the fermions transform as a 4 of SU4 and the scalars transform as a 6 of SU4. And these guys carry charges. And they carry, in particular, charges under the 3 U1s living in the Cartan subalgebra of SU4. So you can imagine introducing 3 independent chemical potentials for these. Now, if you introduce chemical potentials, recalling that the Hamiltonian, which is delta, you have to shift the Hamiltonian by the chemical potential times the charges. So the new Hamiltonian is this. The deformation is by these charges, the conserved currents, which are dimension 3 operators. So we can think of these things as deforming the Lagrangian by a dimension 3 operator, the Hamiltonian. In the Lagrangian language, of course, introducing a chemical potential is like introducing an imaginary A0 component for the U1s for which you are introducing a chemical potential. So introducing that, the imaginary background A0 for any of these U1s can easily see that in the Euclidean language, it generates an effective mass squared term for the fields that are charged under that chemical potential. So there are 3 chemical potentials, and for each chemical potential, a pair of n equals 4 scalar fields, which form a complex combination, a pair of these are charged under one of the chemical potentials. So for each mu p, you get a mass term like that. But importantly, it's a negative mass squared term. So what this means, of course, is that, and we all know this, that if we had a massless theory, or if we had the n equals 4 theory on a plane, then we couldn't introduce a chemical potential. That would just immediately destabilize, at least. On S3, the situation is that we have the conformal mass. We can naturally introduce a small chemical potential for any of these U1s, as long as the chemical potential doesn't exceed the conformal mass term. Okay, so that's our tree-level effective potential, tree-level potential for the scalars in the presence of a chemical potential. Now, Yamada and Larry actually—they're also fermion terms, and they of course they have to be there. I just didn't write them down exactly, so they will come. So those are the dots. I didn't write them. So Yamada and Larry actually looked at the phase diagram of this theory at zero Hooft coupling. So let's do the same thing that we did for the finite temperature theory, but now switching on chemical potentials. And as I said earlier, the energy is unbounded from below for mu greater than a critical value of this chemical potential. So you can do the same analysis. And what they found was that computing this grand canonical partition sum in this Wilsonian language, they found this kind of a phase diagram for the lambda equals zero theory. So plotting it in the mu t plane, you now find that there's a whole line of first order deconfinement or Zn breaking phase transitions. And then there's this blue line above which the theory is completely ill-defined because it doesn't exist. That's including everything, yes, including the fermion. But this is all the free theory. And there are certain qualitative, so depending upon what pattern of chemical potentials you introduce, 1, 2, or 3, equal, unequal, so on and so forth, the angle at which this first order line meets the t equals 0 axis changes. Okay, so there's a nice story there. So that was done. So what we now want to ask is, can we go beyond lambda equals 0, right? And we want to go beyond lambda equals 0, obviously, in a systematic way. So we want to identify first, if I turn on a small coupling, what are the regions in this phase diagram that are actually under control that I can study in perturbation theory? So,
before you go ahead, can you explain what does it mean unstable phase? It must be some kind of
No, it's negative mass squared, and there is no interaction, so it will just...
Yeah, that simply means that something condenses...
No, there are no interactions at lambda equals 0. So if this was lambda phi to the fourth, you're right, right? So you get a condensate. But this is just, you get a minus, you know, you get a negative mass squared term, and there are no interactions. We're studying the strictly free theory, not the weakly coupled theory, okay?
One way to see it is if you want to do the Legendre transform from chemical potential back to the conserved charge.
Right.
You can get any charge you
want. Any charge you want.
Arbitrarily large with chemical potential less than mu c.
Right, so the system...
Charge diverges as mu approaches mu c, which is just the same falling off this, you know, this upside down.
Yeah, the bosons will get condensed.
Piling up. Without bound.
You took out the boson, that's the area.
Totally different story. Mm-hmm. Just
there will be a
usual story of a degenerate Fermi gas.
Yeah.
Well, wouldn't there be a combined place condition?
Yeah, if the theory was just adjoint, then you could still have deconfinement.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can still have deconfinement.
Just go all around.
Mm-hmm.
I could take out the blue line.
Why wouldn't
I thought the blue line would continue forever.
Yeah, yeah, this line continues forever.
Is it continuing forever?
For any t. It's a free theory, so it'll continue forever.
Yeah,
so
that's free theory, but nevertheless, even in free theory, yes, you can have a condensation, positive condensation.
How?
The chemical potential, which is a constant, when the density.
Okay.
So, Brent.
Yeah.
You going to introduce the coupling now because of this flat direction.
We're going to coming to that exactly. So, right. So, indeed. So, I want to identify some of these regions first that are accessible. So there are two interesting regions in this phase diagram once you turn on a coupling constant. And as David said just now, because the n equals 4 theory, its potential is a commutator squared term. If you actually move along the diagonal directions, right, this instability doesn't go away. Okay, so this instability still remains, at least at weak coupling. In perturbation theory, it still remains. So there are following interesting points that, regions that are analytically tractable. One region is, which is interesting, is the region near mu equals mu critical. This region is interesting because while we haven't, assuming that we haven't crossed the critical line, near this region or at this point, we have new light degrees of freedom. Right? So that's interesting. So we have new light modes, and in addition to the, if I switch on a temperature, then there's actually two sets of light modes. There's the Polyakov loop, and there's these light scalars. So you actually want to study the coupled problem of the Polyakov loops with these light scalars in order to understand what the physics is in this region. In the high temperature region, as long as the temperature is not too high, we can again do perturbation theory. So there are two regions that are actually amenable to analytical calculations. And these are the two regions that I'm going to focus on. So the first I'm going to look at, so this is slightly switched chronological order because the high T calculation was first done by Larry and Yamada. So what I'm going to talk about is first small non-zero coupling, but in this near critical domain. So as I said, for mu p greater than mu c, the classical theory is still unstable along mutually commuting scalar directions, right? And as I said, new light interacting scalar degrees of freedom, they emerge near this critical line at low temperatures. And classically, having switched on a coupling constant, okay, having switched on a small non-zero coupling constant, these flat directions at the critical value of the chemical potential, the flat directions are parameterized by the diagonal values of the scalars, right? The diagonal elements. So what we are going to do is imagine that at first we move along one of these flat directions to large diagonal waves. Okay, these are classically flat directions. I still don't know whether quantum mechanically they will remain flat. So what I want to do is actually do a quantum calculation in a region which corresponds to large diagonal waves. The reason I choose large diagonal waves is because then I can reliably integrate out all the off-diagonal fluctuations, the W bosons that get masses when I move along these flat directions. So what I want to do is actually look at all these scalar matrices, and I want to look at these diagonals, and I want to get the effective theory for these diagonals by integrating out all the off-diagonals, which are heavy, and that's completely reliable as long as I move out sufficiently far, and I can do that always because the directions are flat. And of course, as we know, the off-diagonal modes, they get masses like this. So phi I minus phi j squared, the differences of the diagonal squared, plus schematically the L squared is the spherical harmonic squared. So now the calculation, because you're on S3, is what you're really doing is a background field computation. You have some homogeneous modes which correspond to these diagonal waves, and then you want to integrate out all the off diagonals. And so you can do it. It's straightforward. It's just that dealing with the harmonics and stuff is technical. So you work with covariant background field gauge. These are the gauge fixing ghost terms. And there is an added technical complication that if you want to integrate out the fluctuations around these backgrounds, at non-zero chemical potential, it turns out that A0 and all the scalar fluctuations, they mix. The different flavors of fermions also mix. So then you really, I mean, you get a 7x7 matrix which you have to diagonalize for the scalars. You can do that. But you can do that particularly at the critical values of the chemical potential. So I will come to that. So then you want to basically integrate out the off-diagonal modes, and you get fluctuation determinants, which you can interpret as Casimir energy sums. So you have degeneracies for each mode you integrate out, and then you have the energies associated to the modes that you integrate out. And that's an infinite sum. An interesting point to note is that when this critical, there are three critical chemical, there are three chemical potentials, and the cases that we choose is when either one of them is critical, the other two are zero, two are critical, the third is zero, and the three is all three are critical. So these are three possible cases that we can study. And what's interesting is there is a flow, or if you wish, there is a change in the moding of the fields when you switch on these critical chemical potentials. So in fact, for critical chemical potentials, it turns out that fermions, for example, for one critical chemical potential, when these two are zero, when mu one is one, fermions can have integer modings. And this turns out to be, well, this turns out to be important at some stage. But, and then you perform the Casimir sums. Actually, doing the Casimir sums is quite subtle because actually we learned it the hard way. We first did it, did the wrong comp. It's a bit like introducing the chemical. Okay, so the only way I understand it is introducing a chemical potential is like a bit like twisting, right? So you're picking out, it's a bit like twisting, although I can't really make that precise because you have but one way of twisting is precisely that. One way that people do twisting is precisely that, introducing a source for the current or that you're trying to twist. And so that's one way I can think about it, but Okay, so maybe we can talk about this later, but I don't understand better how why this happens. But for any generic chemical potential, of course, these formulas get very complicated, actually. It's only for the critical ones that you get this clean result. But then you have to do the Casimir sums, and doing the Casimir sums is actually subtle, which we realized the hard way. And it turns out that the correct way of doing this, there's probably one way to do it using zeta functions, but the correct way, so to speak, is to use energy cutoffs, cutoffs on the energies rather than the modes. And if you do that at zero temperature and at critical chemical potentials, you get the following one-loop contributions, some mess from bosons, another mess from fermions, then you add the two up and you get a constant. So that means that at this critical chemical potential, there is an exact Bose-Fermi cancellation, at least at this order in perturbation theory. And 3/16th R is just the Casimir energy of N equals 4 fields on a 3 sphere. So that's telling you that at the critical chemical potential, these directions that were classically flat are actually quantum flat directions.
This is just one non-zero chemical potential.
This is also true for 2 and 3, critical. Yeah, all three of them. Zero temperature. Exactly. So the strategy is to study the problem at critical temperature, at the critical potential at zero temperature, then turn on a small temperature. Okay, so once we have identified the fact that the potential is still flat, that means we have control there, and then we can turn on a small temperature. Okay, so the radiative corrections vanish, and the classical flat directions are not lifted. Okay, so if I try to understand what's happening in a more abstract language, for critical chemical potential, you say, let's take the example of one critical chemical potential, since that's the simplest. The Hamiltonian, upon introducing the chemical potential, is just delta minus this charge associated to that potential. And there is a set of states in N equals 4 theory on which this operator actually identically vanishes. And there is an infinite set of such states. These are the half BPS states. Okay, and these are states whose delta does not change under quantum corrections. Okay, so these are special states. So that means that having introduced the chemical potential, at the critical value of the chemical potential, this Hamiltonian actually has an infinite set of degenerate ground states. Infinite set, because there's an infinite set of BPS states in the theory. And you can imagine that this moduli space is precisely a reflection of that. That there is an infinite set of degenerate ground states, and these are parametrizing my so-called moduli space. It's very counterintuitive that you should get flat directions when you're working on a compact space.
Can this be replaced by saying that in some sense when you reach its critical potential, you restore supersymmetry?
You get some supersymmetry. I think the right way to say it is that at the critical chemical potential, the ground states are the supersymmetric states. The ground states are parameterized by the half BPS operators in the theory. Devs for the half BPS operators.
But if I move slightly away, still a zeta dimension, but slightly away from critical potential, these directions will be lifted at one loop?
But by parametrically small amounts, because you have supersymmetry and you're basically softly breaking it in some sense by just moving. So it'll be parametrically small. There are no divergences. You won't get logs of the breaking parameter or anything. Everything will be parametrically controlled. Does that make sense? Because
right, but they'll be lifted. So
yeah, they will be lifted.
In that case, I cannot think about introducing temperature except that.
Well, as long as you move away, supposing you are at the critical point, critical chemical potential, and then you move away slightly, right? As long as that moving away is parametrically small in the coupling constant, that's a higher order effect at a given loop order. So you can systematize that. And that's precisely because you have control here. So these...
J1 is directly to mu0, mu1.
Yeah, so sorry, yeah, J1 corresponds to just switching on mu1 and instead keeping the other two 0.
So generic value away even from mu0, right? There's always BPS states, right?
No, but if mu0 is less than mu, then they're BPS states, but they're not the ground states of the theory. In fact, there is a gap. For generic mu less than 1, the Hamiltonian delta minus mu j, there is a gap. And basically, okay, so, right. So at a generic point on this moduli space, if you wish, there is a charged Bose condensate that parametrized.
So if you move a little bit away from the critical chemical potential,
yes,
you can only move in one direction, right?
Well, that's what I'm coming to, actually.
So there should be presumably some non-analyticity.
As far as I can see, well, okay, I'm coming to that.
But it's actually a three-dimensional space.
Yeah.
You cannot move along the critical surface as well.
You can move along the critical surface as well, yeah.
So from this argument, for u rather than any disclosed value, always BPS states.
Mu larger than lowest value?
Not just critical value, but any value larger than.
Yeah, there's BPS states, but the question is, I'm asking what is, so this is my Hamiltonian,
right,
and I'm asking what are the ground states of this Hamiltonian?
Yeah.
Right, so then if I move away from the critical chemical potential, well, you know, there's some other ground states, but they're not parametrized by the BPS states. In fact, I don't know what's happening. I'm going to come to that, just bear with me. Right, for 2 and 3 critical chemical potentials, the ground states are then parametrized by the quarter and 1/8 BPS states. Okay, so now I want to switch on a very small temperature, still staying at the critical chemical potential. And this calculation can be done. So as long as the temperature is, well, you can do it at one loop order. And as long as the temperature is sufficiently small, noting that introducing a temperature means also introducing Polyakov lines in the theory, you get a joint, as I said, a joint effective potential for the diagonal modes of the scalars, which are light, and the diagonal modes of the Polyakov lines, which are also light. So you get this joint potential. What is interesting that has happened at this critical chemical potential is that normally when you put this theory on a finite volume and you look for the effective potential experienced by diagonal modes, by integrating out off diagonals, you typically get a van der Waals repulsive force, a logarithmic force, because you're on finite volume between these diagonal modes. What happens at the critical chemical potential is that these new light states that appear, their contribution exactly cancels the van der Waals, okay? And that's why you get these flat directions, otherwise you wouldn't, okay? So one of the nice things is that this repulsive force that the eigenvalues felt at low temperatures is just not there. The only thing that is there, it's very easy to see, is that these pairwise forces between these eigenvalues, alpha, the Polyakov loop eigenvalues, they're actually attractive potentials. So in fact, therefore, you can, with impunity, minimize this effective potential and find that the Polyakov lines are actually all sitting on top of each other. It's a delta function distribution at any finite temperature. So that means these guys are one. Okay?
Sorry. So presumably, I cannot go for large phi ij's, right? Because then it won't be consistent to integrate out of
that. It's actually completely consistent at large phi ij's for two reasons. One is that for large phi ij's, the degrees of freedom that you're integrating out, they're very heavy.
Right.
So quantum corrections actually become very small. And in fact, that's what you see here. At large phi ij's, these are exponentially killed. So in fact, in the n equals 4 theory, it's a generic feature that you expect quantum corrections, at least in perturbation theory, if you compute an effective potential for the diagonal modes, you expect the quantum corrections to be killed at very large field amplitudes. So I don't expect it to be valid, but the reason it's valid is because it's because I found that there are flat directions. Because I didn't make any approximations along the way.
Yeah.
It is valid, indeed. At the moment, all I'm saying is that I'm looking at these Coulomb branch directions, if you wish, and I can look at the region near the origin because it's completely analytic.
I'm sorry, I just got confused. What do you mean by phi ij?
Phi ij is phi I minus phi j, so modulus of that. Yeah. So they could all be zero also. They could all be zero. Yes, in fact, so as all alpha I equals zero in the deconfined phase, you are in the deconfined phase, U1 equals one. Right, I've said this. And if you look at this potential, as you said, for small phi ij's, it has a positive curvature, as you might expect, because introducing a temperature wants to kind of give a small mass to the system. It's an exponentially small mass.
Sorry. What I said was, I had it wrong way, but so exactly for small, when you do this computation, you assume that you integrate out of the
right.
And so precisely the prefactor that you got, 8t, assuming that you integrate it out.
Right.
But it's, now you have to worry at least for small.
No, there's nothing to worry because the effects of integrating them out were cancelled. So there are no non-analyticities in this formula as phi I approaches phi j. That should tell you that what I did is correct, even at small phi. If I did something wrong, you should see a non-analyticity. You should see a log or something, right? So everything is fine here. So which is the reason why I can now parametrically ask, well, in this computation at the critical chemical potential and small temperature, I now find that the scalar directions have a small mass at finite temperature. So I can now imagine increasing this chemical potential, thinking of it as just a parameter, dialing it to a value slightly greater than mu critical, right? I can always do that, as long as I ensure that the error that I make in doing that is actually higher order. I can do that, at least just to see whether the theory makes sense. Yeah, that's the tree level potential is what the tree level potential. So in fact, the tree level potential has the instability. So this is just the one loop term. So there's V0 plus V1. V0 is, in my normalization, it's 1 over lambda times trace phi squared, or sum over the diagonal squared, times mu critical squared minus mu squared. Okay, so if I make mu squared a little bit greater than mu critical, this goes negative, but I have now this extra term, right? So up to numerical factors, as long as I ensure that this negative curvature over is smaller than this positive curvature, I have a stable vacuum, right? Locally stable vacuum.
But the positive curvature terms are only for differences.
No, but at quadratic order, well, the differences are the same as the sums. If I take summation of phi ij squared, phi I minus phi j squared, and then sum over all i's, that's the same as sum of phi I minus phi j whole squared is the same as, provided sum of phi I equals zero, right?
That's what I need to be reminded about.
Right. So that means that if you increase the chemical potential a little bit above critical at finite temperature, then along, so this is not properly labeled, this is any of these diagonal guys, if I pull them out and I ask what is the potential like, then what I'm going to see is something like this, where this bottom actually dips exponentially small amount, e to the minus 1 over t, right? And this peak is also actually controlled by e to the minus 1 over t. At large distances, the potential runs away. It's a negative mass squared potential. That's the classical instability. But this means that above the critical chemical potential, there's a small region where the theory has a metastable vacuum. which breaks supersymmetry. And in fact, the thing that condenses there are precisely these half BPS operators. Those are the guys that got light, so it's not surprising, they condense. So for low temperatures, there is a metastable state, which in this particular window, and actually it's completely consistent. You can see that this difference between mu minus mu critical is also proportional to the coupling constant. So actually any effect that I have, so the fact that I, in the one loop computation, I have used the result for the critical chemical potential, I've made an error which is higher order. So it will reflect in a two loop term. So you can compute, of course, what's the probability for an eigenvalue to jump up thermally or to cross the barrier by tunneling out. And you will see that it's exponential of minus capital N times this number. So when actually the N goes to infinity limit, the lifetime is extremely large. But nevertheless, there is this instability. Nevertheless, there is a non-zero probability, of course, for this eigen, for a single diagonal mode to tunnel out. So now I'm going to add a little bit to this corner of the phase diagram. So what we see now is that at low temperatures, there is this small region, the blue line has shifted a little bit at small couplings. And I have a metastable band whose width is exponentially small. Now I'm going to go to the analysis that was first done before what I did. So this was done by, again, Larry and Yamada. And their analysis was in the high temperature regime. And basically it relied on just at high temperatures, writing down an effective theory for the static modes in the theory, right? And at sufficiently high temperatures, if TR is much greater than 1, and provided that the size of the 3 sphere is actually not too large. In other words, it shouldn't approach something like the magnetic screening scale of the theory, because then perturbation theory makes no sense. At high temperatures, in the regime that the radius of the 3 sphere is of the same order as the Debye scale of the theory, their computation basically is summarized in these following steps. At high temperatures, the scalar fields will have a thermal mass, lambda T squared, near the origin, right? We all know that. And there is this added fact that if I move out to large values in field space, then quantum corrections are suppressed because the off-diagonal modes can't contribute. They become very heavy. So there is again a band in chemical potential space, which is now controlled by basically these two limits. And in this particular region, there is a metastable phase near the origin, which was their conclusion. So the analysis, if we put all this together, well, this was the kind of the potential that they would draw. And then you end up with a weak coupling phase diagram in the mu t plane that looks basically like this, right? If you put everything together. High temperature metastable region, low temperature metastable region, beyond the blue line, the theory is completely unstable. And perturbatively, I don't know what the endpoint of that instability is. Okay? Right. So it's, of course, not hard to imagine that that blue line at high temperatures actually probably smoothly joins up with the blue line at low temperatures. So now I did all this for weak coupling, so I want to compare it with the picture that is known at strong coupling. Right? At strong coupling, what we are talking about is at low temperatures, a thermal ADS space, which is actually spinning in the S5 directions. And at high temperatures, you cross this Hawking page, the confinement transition, and then you're talking about charged ADS black holes. So ADS black holes that carry charge because the angular momentum around the S5 basically manifests itself as charge. So you have this phase. And it is also known that these charged ADS black holes don't exhibit any instability until they reach a blue line which is known in gravity. Of course, the equation for this critical chemical potential as a function of temperature, its functional form is very different from what we get at weak coupling. Except at high temperatures, this is linear. At high temperatures, that's also linear. Okay. What I know is that weak coupling, that is exponentially small, that band. I think this has some power law behavior as a function of temperature. Okay. But you can take heart from the fact that these two diagrams are beginning to look rather similar. So maybe there is some aspect of the physics at weak coupling which you've got right, and that got gets the phase diagram for gravity right.
Somewhat similar.
Really
the same.
But not the functions, right? The functions are there are details. First thing is there is a metastable phase there. Okay, so the first question you'll ask is there a metastable phase here? And I actually only very recently found out that Daisuke had a paper from a year ago where he claims to have shown that the one charged black hole is metastable in this region. So the endpoint is not known. He's just drawn the free energies as a function of charges, and he's found that there is actually eventually, if you dial the parameters that of the system, the metastable state will just, you know, go up to infinity. As a function of, the thermodynamic?
To show that it's metastable, you have to show that there's either this runaway.
It was runaway. Runaway, that's what I'm saying. Runaway, instability all the way down. That's what I mean here, with the question mark. There's an instability, I don't know what the end point is. Right, so in gravity, you can get these curves for turning on 1, 2, or 3 mu's, and then actually things change. So it's not exactly the same, because depending upon whether you have 3, 2, or 1 critical mu's, this point here where these two lines meet may be at t equals 0 or may not be. So it's only when all three chemical potentials are critical is when this meeting point is at the t equals 0 axis. Otherwise, you get you get this point where you have a black hole with zero horizon size, effectively. At weak coupling, for three chemicals, so for 2 and 3, the analysis is not as clean as I presented for one, and actually it looks qualitatively different to me. Although the conclusion of the existence of the metastable phase persists, I think, all the way to t equals 0. So in that sense, if that conclusion is correct for 2 and 3 chemical potentials, there is again a small qualitative difference between these two pictures, which one should try maybe to understand better. So that's basically all I wanted to say about weak strong, and I think I'm way over time. So I wanted to say a bunch of things, but maybe I should finish by saying a couple of things. That since this is a non-equilibrium workshop and I've only talked about equilibrium quantities, maybe I should say a few words about time-dependent quantities that one should think about. And so in this weak-strong comparison, so one can take a lot of encouragement from looking at thermodynamic quantities and the fact that things are qualitatively similar somewhat. But one should, of course, pay attention also to time-dependent quantities. And one of the things that we did a while ago was to look at time-dependent correlators for some generic gauge invariant operators like trace F squared. It doesn't give you any transport coefficient because it does not correspond to any conserved charge. But if you just compute this correlator in the free theory, this is what you get, a bunch of branch cuts. And that's not surprising because any perturbative calculation, essentially, when you're doing a diagrammatic calculation, you can cut the diagrams open and you will see these branch cuts. So the long time behavior will be governed by essentially this kind of analytic structure of the retarded propagator on the lower half plane.
This is
the free theory. This is the free theory. This is the free theory. Now I turn on a small coupling, the cuts don't go away, right? But I also don't know what the exact form of this correlator is. What you know is that there's lots of cuts at any finite weak coupling. It's all sorts of branches.
Is there a cut on the real axis at finite coupling?
At finite coupling, sorry, are you asking whether there'll be a cut on the real axis? Well, if you do it order by order in perturbation theory, I think things only get worse. You get all sorts of cuts on the real axis. Well, I think there are experts here who can probably, if you go to two loops, the situation becomes even worse. But I think we know from all the analysis of Larry's and others that basically at very long times, whatever correlator you compute, at long times, eventually, there will be exponential decay of everything, of all these correlators. So I don't know what the analytic structure is. Not for transport coefficient. Transport coefficients will have power laws. But for example, trace F squared eventually will decay exponentially. No. You don't think so?
No, there's always power laws, even in correlators like this, coming from the fact that they can couple to two or more hydrodynamic modes.
So are you saying that eventually anything I compute will decay only by power laws at very late times?
As long as there's any coupling whatsoever to the hydrodynamic sector of the theory, yes.
Right. Shouldn't I be worried then? Because here I will only get exponential.
It's a large n.
Yeah. So that's the question I'm asking. At large n, you're saying that.
So the effect I described something that you can think of as analogous to a one or higher loop effect in terms of the effective low-energy theory, and the couplings have 1/n's in them.
Okay, so you can always show this for any correlator then, that eventually...
That's a little strong, but this is certainly a story that showed up in the example that I looked at most carefully, where you do have these long-time tails, and you can really understand them, and you can really see that at large n, just as Ram just said, there's a 1/n suppression.
Right. In any case, I think there is a kind of dichotomy between these two pictures which one would like to understand better. Maybe there's an exactly solvable or a toy model, some example, where one can actually see that you don't really have these cuts, but actually somehow, if you could compute these things exactly, you would find a series of poles, which are the things that correspond to the quasi-normal modes of black holes at strong coupling. Maybe I should stop there because I'm...
diagram in the plane of T and mu, you put T on the vertical axis and mu on the horizontal, it's not how it is similar to computing.
Yeah, I know. Except that that line goes and hits the T equals zero axis, or the mu equals zero axis.
But it will also hit in QCD if there are no quarks.
Yeah, sure, but that's not QCD. That's mu if there are no quarks.
Questions?